Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
I'm Carrie Miller, and this is NPR News. And now we're in depth on how to be the change that saves the world. There's a small coastal city in China in the midst of a grand and perhaps game-changing experiment. In a country that has deep, urgent environmental challenges, one of its oldest cities, Rizhao, is attempting to go carbon neutral. Science writer David Biello describes the extraordinary challenge of this in a new book, in which we meet scientists and advocates and average people who refuse to be daunted by the odds of getting ahead of climate change. He writes, "I will argue that we must accept the responsibility that comes with the power that humanity now possesses." We're going to talk about what that means. David Biello's book is titled The Unnatural World, The Race to Remake Civilization in Earth's Newest Age. And he joins us today from New York City. And David, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me.
I use the word urgent in the introduction. You call this a race to remake civilization. What I wonder is if most of us, not just Americans, but, you know, global citizens, feel that kind of imperative, that kind of urgency.
Well, I think we're feeling the urgency a bit more and more with each passing year. And perhaps for some of us, the most recent election increased that urgency even a little bit more. So I feel that there is a momentum gathering for the changes that are going to be needed. But the reality is that we are in a race. We have 100 years or so to kind of figure out the temperatures we want to exist under for the next couple of centuries, the conditions we want our coasts to be in for the next couple of centuries, whether we want to be able to go ice fishing and ice boating for the next couple of centuries. It is a race, and the choices that we make today, and by we, I mean all of us all around the globe, will set the conditions for the next century or more.
You know, the Paris Accord notwithstanding, I feel like that momentum that you're talking about, and I think this is buttressed by some of the people that you introduce us to in this book, is happening not by governments that are leading this, but by community organizations and individuals and maybe smaller governments that are experimenting with, innovation and imagination. Tell me what you'd say about that.
Yeah, I'd say that's exactly right. We are not seeing, let's say, the action from national governments or international organizations that would be needed to, you know, take real action on climate change. We are seeing folks in various local communities kind of rise up and make choices that that will help not just their local community, though that's often why they're doing it, but also the whole globe. So you mentioned the example of Rizhao in China, where I visited multiple times, and I profile a character there by the name of Fan Changwei. He's not a saint by any means. For example, he chain smokes religiously. That is probably his one true religion. And I like him for that. But he is also the one tasked with turning this tiny little coastal city carbon neutral, which for those who don't know, means that it would emit no more carbon dioxide than it would take in or destroy.
And this is,
that's an incredible challenge to undertake, especially in China, where they are, if this is possible, even more reliant on coal than perhaps we are here in the United States or Europe is or any of the other developed nations. They use coal for everything from heating to electricity. And attempting to go carbon neutral under those conditions is a daunting challenge. But he's taken it on with the help of several packs of cigarettes a day.
I think you've used the right word for him. He's such a character. He's also, for me, one of the most idealistic activists that you introduced us to. And this is what I wondered about: all these different people from all these different places, where that common drive came from. And yes, they're concerned about the health of the planet and their own environments. But there's something else, isn't there? Up against these great odds, what drives these people?
There really is. And I would say across the board, it's hope. It sounds pretty simple, and I guess it is. It's a hope for a better future, most often for their children, sometimes for them, for themselves, sometimes for their city. It's hope that the future can be brighter, not darker, that perhaps some of the things that went wrong in the past can be set right. So sticking with China, they are experiencing pollution that is unimaginable by current American standards. Smogs that won't let you see more than 5 feet in front of your face,
wow,
that make you feel like you've smoked five packs of cigarettes, even if you haven't. And this is not something that, say, anyone from the highest leader, the president of China, on down can avoid. This kind of air pollution is damaging everyone's lungs and shortening everyone's lives. And so that gives people a lot of drive to try to clean things up. And they look to us. They look to the United States and they say, hey, back in the 1910s and the 1920s, the U.S. was just as dirty as we are. And they remained as dirty as we are until the 1950s and the 1960s and the 1970s, when we decided that, you know what, we don't want killer smogs anymore. And people organized and they legislated, and we got things like the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act. And you know what? The air got cleaner and the water got cleaner. It's not perfect, but it's better. And we are where we are today, and that's where China wants to be as soon as they possibly can.
Of course, what you just described was a democracy, right, taking some of this into its own hands and saying this is the kind of change that we demand. Does it matter that this kind of change has to happen in the kind of authoritarian government that China has? Is it easier, maybe?
Well, it's a great question. On the one hand, it's easier to implement something, right? If you can convince the Chinese leadership that something needs to be done, let's say a dam needs to be built, then boy, is it easy for them to say, you know what, we're going to build that dam right over there on that river, and there's not much you can do about it. But at the same time, most countries in the world have a social contract of one form or another, wherein the great mass of people agree to be ruled by the small group of people at the top in exchange for kind of a better life. And the deal in China has been, we will allow you to prosper and get ahead economically. Despite being communist in name, we will allow you to be as capitalist as you want to be, as long as you allow us to retain power. That bargain is now shifting because the people below are like, hey, we're a little bit richer. We're a little bit better off than we were, say, 20, 30 years ago. And you know what? We want our kids to be able to breathe. We want our kids to drink water that's safe. We want our kids to eat food that's safe. And so they are looking to the U.S. and the kind of regulations that we have to guide them to that slightly better future. But that is really coming from the bottom up. That is a people-focused movement. And I would say the same kind of thing is happening here in the U.S. at the local level. You know, California isn't acting because
right.
Governor Jerry Brown wants to act on climate change. California is acting because Californians want to act on climate change. And the same will be true for the United States at some point.
Here's the thing that always that I find disconcerting when I read about what's happening in China. And since you've been there so much, you're a good person to ask this of. Even as they're building new cities and they are clearly committed to renewable energy and developing technology, and, you know, as President Obama has warned many times, they may end up leading this because the United States has fallen behind on that. And yet, as they build these new cities and they have access to this technology, they are still relying on coal. They're still building new coal plants. Are these new coal plants cleaner than the ones that we, you know, that we're used to traditionally? And how does that get in the way of their investment in clean energy?
Well, they are cleaner than the ones we're used to. But you know what? That's not good enough, because a coal plant is a coal plant, and there's no way to make a coal plant carbon neutral at this point. There are some technologies under development. You might have heard of carbon capture and storage.
Right.
Certainly, President-elect Donald Trump is a big fan of quote unquote clean coal. But these are things that have only been demonstrated at this point. They are not kind of working in principle. We have a couple clean coal plants here in the U.S. They are incredibly expensive and have not worked quite as well as one had hoped. China also has a couple clean coal plants. They also were incredibly expensive and have not worked quite as well as hoped. Now, it is possible that that technology will develop faster than perhaps some skeptics think. But at the scale of the problem that we're talking about, we need to be shifting away from coal if we're concerned about climate change. And really, the focus of the problem shifts now, not from China to India, because China has done what it's going to do. They have the coal plants and they're going to burn the coal. And the question is, how quickly do they clean up and shift away from coal? India doesn't have the coal plants yet, but they might build them. And if they do, they will have followed the same kind of industrialization path that was followed by the countries of Europe, by the United States, by Japan, and now China. And they will add a heavy burden of pollution to the atmosphere that we all share, the air that we all breathe. If they do that, then we're in for some pretty serious climate change. If they do not, if they find another way to develop, if they are able to buy clean technologies from the U.S. or China. And that's another aspect of this race. Are we going to be the ones selling the clean technology, or is China going to be the one selling the clean technology?
Looks like it's China at the moment, doesn't it?
It is China at the moment. And that's where the jobs of the future are. So if the incoming administration really wants to create jobs here in the U.S., then they should be focused on these kind of exportable clean technologies, which really are going to be the wave of the future. And we have fallen behind in that race. There's no doubt about it. So to catch up would be quite an achievement for a Trump presidency.
David Biello is with us. If you've tuned in to the conversation, he's the author of The Unnatural World, The Race to Remake Civilization in Earth's Newest Age. We're going to talk about the name he gives to that newest age and how it connects to climate change. But part of the book is really about introducing us to unusually idealistic people in different parts of the world who are working on, I'd say against some pretty daunting odds, working on environmental change and coming up with some really imaginative and innovative solutions. If you have questions about the overall issue here or about some of the things that we're talking about in this conversation, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. I'm on Twitter at @CarrieMPR. I want to talk about this paleobiologist who tells you that we've reset, that's his word, the planet's biology. And you say that we're at this new geologic age. And there's, I mean, this sounds like there's a no turning back kind of warning to this. Is that it?
There is definitely a no turning back warning, because it's not just climate change. There are a whole host of other environmental problems, some of which are much worse than climate change. There is the challenge of feeding somewhere between 7 and 10 billion people on this one Earth. There is the challenge of ocean acidification, which is probably the only phrase more boring than climate change, but actually happens to be.
I find it fascinating. I really do. We talk about it a lot.
Good. I'm glad. But you and I are in the minority on that one. This is the souring of the ocean, if you will, which is not great for the tiny little microscopic plants that we all rely on for the oxygen that we breathe. So ocean acidification is one that might scare you a little bit, and should. We are undergoing an extinction crisis where species are disappearing. This is that extinction crisis has extended over about 40,000 years now. So it's a long, slow process that maybe we haven't noticed as much as we should have. But on a geologic scale, that is overnight. Everything we're doing is happening just incredibly quickly. And that's another aspect of this challenge. The problems have kind of set in more quickly than the Earth is used to. And so we're going to have to solve these problems a little more quickly than the Earth is used to, because the Earth has ways to clean up after us. We just might not like those ways, and they might not happen as fast as we would want.
You know, and David, I was thinking about that exact thing. Over at the end of December, I was in a place where we were surrounded by ocean. And as I looked out of the ocean, I kept thinking about the saturation, that day that's coming where the oceans cannot accept the amount of carbon dioxide, you know, and they work hard to do that. But we may reach a time when when the oceans cannot accept any more of that carbon.
That's right.
Yeah. How does that figure into the way you think about this new geologic age?
Well, it's not just the oceans. It's also the plants on land. Up to a certain extent, more CO2 is good for plants. That's plant food out there, and they'll get a little greener as a result. But that only goes to a certain point. And it also relies on drought and kind of temperatures to cooperate so the plants can get greener. Ocean saturation, we may be on the cusp of that, and the oceans seem to have slowed a bit in their carbon uptake. And that's why some of the folks that I profile in the book, like Viktor Smetichek, want to try to help natural processes in the oceans take up more carbon than they're used to. I mentioned the microscopic plants before. Technically, they're called phytoplankton. Mm-hmm. These are the tiny little green dots of the sea that are responsible for about one in every three breaths you take, maybe as much as every other breath you take. So they're quite important on a planetary scale, despite the fact that you can't see them with your naked eye. We could fertilize the oceans and make life a little bit better for these tiny little plants. And then, as the oceans kind of bloom with these phytoplankton, they could sink and bury some of that carbon with them and kind of restore a little bit the conditions that existed before we put all that CO2 from burning coal and oil and natural gas into the atmosphere. That's one idea, and maybe a little bit of a crazy idea. But if you think about it, the oceans are 70% of the globe. So really, we shouldn't be calling this planet Earth. We should [S2] Right. [S1] Be calling it ocean. And perhaps we should enlist the ocean, the biggest system on the planet, in the fight against climate change, against mass extinction, and against these other problems we talked about.
A call here for you from Brian in Chaska. Hey, Brian, what are you thinking about? Hi.
How are you guys doing? I love your program. I appreciate hearing, and I hope lots of people are listening. Okay. Listen, I'm a geologist. I've called in before. I just wanted to point out one thing. I heard earlier that the problem's India, not China. China's built all these coal plants. They're all done. Well, just like in America, they're converting coal to natural gas, which is 100 times cleaner, and mm-hmm. it's a bridge to the future. And China could do the same thing. They could do it tomorrow. And they're not going to do it because of a James Taylor song or your program. They're going to do it because it's cheaper.
All right.
So I just wanted to point that out. We shouldn't let China off the hook. And I got the feeling the coming administration isn't inclined to do so. So just like in America, natural gas can provide us a bridge. And it's fracking, and natural gas has lowered our carbon footprint more than any other technology, including wind and solar.
David?
I'll take it on.
Weigh in on that.
Yeah, that is absolutely true. Actually, our CO2 emissions as a country are back to levels last seen in the 1990s, thanks to burning natural gas. And in fact, the death of coal that has been widely ascribed to, Obama administration policies and whatever else, are actually due to the economics of cheap natural gas. Utility executives realize that natural gas is cheap, and so they'll burn the cheaper fuel. The same is true in China. The problem has been that fracking hasn't worked quite as well over there due to the geologic conditions. But the hope is that they can get more, that they can shift more and more onto a cleaner burning fuel. And then that might, as he said, build a bridge to an even cleaner future. Because the reality is, even natural gas is not clean enough in the long run, on the centuries-long time scale.
And so, David, let's be sure we say that fracking is not without environmental consequences, too, right?
Oh, absolutely. Sure. One of the things that I have learned about energy in reporting on it over many decades at this point, which I hate to admit, is that there is nothing that is without trade-offs. There is no energy source that is the perfect solution to all our problems. There are trade-offs to wind and solar. There's trade-offs to nuclear. There are obviously trade-offs to all the fossil fuels. Fracking can be done safely, but it requires regulation to do so. And so more often than not, we have found that fracking has not come without consequences, whether that be the dumping of the water that is produced along with the natural gas, whether that be leaking natural gas, which is a terrible greenhouse gas in its own right, or whether that be high levels of air pollution in the areas around the fracking wells. So fracking has not come without consequences, that's for sure.
I want to talk about population growth because I think it's important the way you wrote about it in the book. You know, I often hear from people in these conversations who are despairing of how many people there are on Earth, and they tend to focus on places like India and Africa. And you write, you better be aware of the disproportionate use of resources when you're going to talk about population growth. And you say this: what matters most is not total numbers, but the relative impact of each individual. Only a small percentage of that big 7 billion number contributes most to the problem of a disappearing world. And America plays a big part in that.
That's right. The developed world bears the biggest, slice of the blame for the world that we find ourselves in now. Consumption is the bigger problem than absolute population numbers. And believe it or not, this might come as a surprise to many folks out there. The population problem is actually resolving itself. We had peak baby way back when I was born in the 1970s, and the number of new individuals added to the earth each year has declined over the last four decades and will continue to decline. And that's why we are likely to peak at 9 or 10 billion people on the planet, depending on kind of how if something changes those trends. But it doesn't look like anything is going to change those trends. And what has that come from? It has not come from some kind of governmental program or top-down control of any kind. It has come from the fact that child mortality has fallen significantly. And when you are reasonably confident that your child, your one or two children, are going to grow up happy and healthy and have a shot at a decent future, then you are likely to refrain from having that third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh baby to help you work the farm and to provide for you when you're too old to continue to work.
The problem I have with the way the population growth people, and I'm sure I'm going to get emails on this, is that rarely do they say the real issue is the way, as you say, the developed world uses the resources that all of us have to share. It's really, why don't those people in India stop having babies? Well, you've just given us some context that says that they have. But that seems to be a very unnuanced way to talk about population growth and climate change.
That's true. And when you think about it, about 5% of the globe's population, mostly in the United States, use about 25% of all the resources that we use around the world. They're the same resources like fossil fuels that are contributing most to the problem of climate change, of species extinction, you name it. It's the 5% that are kind of driving that bus of ecological change. And looking at those consumption habits and changing those consumption habits is the real battle of this new era, which some geologists are calling the Anthropocene. That's the hope that somehow by looking at this in a broader context, not just climate change, but also all these other environmental problems and people's problems, and trying to resolve people's problems and environmental problems at the same time may give us a chance rather than trying to kind of knock them off one by one in isolation, which is how we've gotten ourselves into messes in the past. One great example is ethanol from corn. We did that for energy security, but it ended up exacerbating kind of our climate change issues and the dead zone issue down there at the mouth of the Mississippi. Those were not anticipated impacts, and we want to try to avoid those because we don't have as much room for kind of unanticipated mistakes as we used to have, thanks to all this resource consumption.
David Biello here. He's a science writer, and we're talking about his book, The Unnatural World. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter at CarrieNPR. To Darian in St. Cloud. Hey, Darian, thanks so much for waiting.
Hey, thank you very much for having me on your show.
Of course.
I just had a quick question. I've been kind of looking around at these renewable energy sources, and I've seen a really interesting technology, liquid thorium fluoride reactors, kind of as a substitute for, you know, traditional uranium reactors and these coal power plants. And I see that there's a lot of research been done, and there's some definite promise in it, but there seems to be a lack of an investment and further development in those reactors. I'm just trying to figure out why that might be.
David, do you know?
It's a great question. Liquid thorium reactors have been a favorite of many kind of engineers over the last several decades and yet have never kind of reached commercial operation. There's some challenges around the technology, and let's face it, nuclear of any flavor is not the most popular technology in the world. If anything, especially in the United States, nuclear power is on the wane rather than a growth technology. There are people out there trying to fight that, but so far the economics are against them. Cheap natural gas, which I mentioned killing coal, is also killing nuclear. So like I said, there are trade-offs to every technology. So liquid thorium reactors are actually under development in, you will probably be able to guess this, in China. And it's another technology that they may be able to steal a march on us on. We kind of invented it as part of the Cold War developments out of our national labs, but didn't want to pursue it. And now the Chinese are pursuing it. They may end up perfecting it, or at least making it better. I guess nothing's ever perfect. Making it better, making it work, and then perhaps selling that technology on to India or wherever else, and reaping the benefits, the economic benefits of that.
I appreciated your pursuit and your chapter on Elon Musk, because he's the guy you really want to talk to. He is astonishing. He has this mantra, I think you tell us about, fail often but fail fast, and that's influencing his the way he looks to other planets and building the technology to get to Mars. But I wanted to play a bit of the 60 Minutes profile of him that reveals how he went into the space business with very little experience or knowledge, and put in this big stake, you know, of his own money, of his reputation. So this is from 60 Minutes, and this is Scott Pelley asking him what drives Elon Musk. Let's listen.
Why even begin?
When something is important enough, you do it even though the odds are not in your favor.
How much of your personal fortune have you poured into this?
$100 million.
$100 million into something that you did not believe would work at the beginning.
Yes.
You know, when I see Elon Musk, I think I'm grateful that he's doing all of this in this country, right? That he thinks America is a place to do this. What did you learn about him?
Well, immigrants, they're often more driven, right?
Exactly.
Elon Musk, in many ways, personifies the kind of person we're going to need to solve the challenges of this new geologic age that we're entering as a result of our own impacts. He is looking for a backup plan in case we fail. That's the mission to Mars. But most of his fortune is actually invested in solving the problems here on Earth, in his electric car company, Tesla, and in his cousin's solar photovoltaic company, SolarCity. Those two companies are meant to be a solution to our power and transportation issues.
Man.
We want to be able to drive around, and we want to be able to have cold beer in our fridge and air conditioning in a hot summer and heat in a cold winter. The hope is that clean electricity from solar panels can provide that, and then that clean electricity can go into the batteries in an electric car, a Tesla, built for you by Elon Musk and his team. And if you get all that right, if you can get all that working, then we can cut CO2 emissions drastically. And that's exactly what we need to do. But he is one of these people that you talked about early on in our conversation, perhaps unusually idealistic. But there are more of them than you may think. And honestly, we should be glad of that, because it's going to take way more than just Elon Musk to get us out of this problem.
David, he believes in a carbon tax, though. And I mean, I would ask, having read about other people who make these arguments for a carbon tax, that it looks like it's inevitable. It's not a matter of if, but when.
Yeah, you know who else believes in a carbon tax? Rex Tillerson, who may or may not be our next Secretary of State.
Yeah.
Now, whether that's a position of convenience or true belief, I can't say for sure. But a carbon tax is the solution to climate change that economists love and people hate, because it has the word tax in it. And that sounds bad to most folks. But the way economists think about it is, right now, we have taxes on things like jobs, which we want, and we don't have taxes on things like pollution, which we don't want. So why not put the tax on the pollution bring the pollution down, and at the same time take the taxes off the jobs, which we do want, mm-hmm. bring jobs up.
Yeah.
That is what a carbon tax is designed to do at its most simplistic level. And who knows, perhaps a Trump administration will be kind of like Nixon going to China and be the administration that brings in a carbon tax. I'm not going to hold my breath for that one, though.
Yeah, but I didn't know that Tillerson supported the carbon tax. I hope that comes out in the confirmation hearings. Be interesting to hear him talk about that.
It should. Yeah. I mean, it should. They should ask him those questions, right? And along with the Putin questions and all the rest of them, there are a lot of interesting conversations to be had. And then how does that work with Scott Pruitt over at the Environmental Protection Agency,
right.
or Rick Perry at the Department of Energy? How is this cast of characters going to work together, and what exactly their agenda is going to be remains unclear. All we have is Twitter to go on.
Call here for you from Justin in Superior. Hey, Justin, just a couple of minutes, so if you can make it concise.
Sure. I just really wanted to say I appreciate you talking about general consumption in addition to the green fuels. I really think consumption is the biggest problem. You know, the United States has the highest GDP in the world, even mm-hmm. higher than China. Mm-hmm. And we tend to point at China as being a big polluter. But really, I think that's their pollution is linked to our consumption. And I think I don't like talking about, I'm an engineer, and I don't like talking about cost linked to energy. I think obviously we have to as a capitalist country. But if we really wanted to solve the problems, I think we would fix a monetary value to an energy value, like $1 equals 1 watt, and then we would truly solve our problem.
Let's bring in David, the engineers, to fix this. I like the way Justin thinks there. What would you say?
That's right. Well, the engineers are definitely going to be called upon to solve our problems here, because we need some new technologies. We need to improve some of the existing technologies, and we need to bring some rationality to our political solutions as well. But the real core of this problem is in us, right? It's human nature. It's the technology is there, the resources are there, believe it or not. It's just a matter of will. It's just a matter of us kind of adopting this perhaps unusually idealistic mindset that some of the folks I profile in the book have, and applying that to our day-to-day life. For example, if you've ever been to Europe, you know that they live a lifestyle that is not unpleasant. They seem to have a pretty good life,
looks
right?
Looks pretty good, yeah.
Yeah, it looks pretty good, right? And they use about 50% of the resources that the average American uses.
Jeez.
Now, America is a bigger country, so we have that challenge in front of us. But there's no reason that we couldn't live a European style of life or quality of life with American characteristics and cut our consumption in half. And that would go so far towards solving all of these environmental challenges while creating jobs that it seems like a no-brainer. But we haven't done it yet, but I remain hopeful that we will someday.
David, in 2017, I want to read more great books like yours about science. So what should be at the top of my list?
Oh, man. The last great science book I read was I Contain Multitudes by Ed Yong.
Maggie Hirth-Baker mentioned that yesterday.
Oh, yeah, Maggie.
Yeah.
That's great. Well, you've got that's a twofer. We've got two recommendations for that book. It's a great book. We'll tell you all about the insides of your body, things you didn't want to know.
But need to know.
But need to know. Exactly.
David, this has been a pleasure. Love the book. Really appreciate the conversation. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
David Biello's book is called The Unnatural World, The Race to Remake Civilization in Earth's Newest Age. And you can read all about it on the thread, mprnews.org/thread.